Chapter 20. An odd shudder traveled up my right leg and rattled my ribs, shaking me all along the length of my tattoos. It woke me with a start and made Granuel jump.
"Kya, what the hell was that?"
she asked, staring at the tattoos on her arm as if they would provide an answer. Frowning, she turned to me and saw I was awake.
"Did you feel that?"
Oberon roused and yawned.
"Feel what?"
"Yeah, I felt it."
"What's happening? Are we about to be trampled by a herd of English football fans?"
"So what was it?"
Granuel said. "The last time I felt this was when Perrin's plane died."
"Oh no."
"Yeah, some plane connected to Earth has been destroyed."
"Does that mean Loki is free?"
"Probably, unless someone else is destroying planes." The shuddering continued, and I extended my thoughts to the English elemental, Albion. Disturbance detected. Query, source. The reply confirmed my fears. Old plane of the Finns. Burning. Albion says it's a plane of the Finns.
How many do they have? Not as many as the Irish, I hope.
No, I can't think of many. Unless it's Twinella, their land of the dead.
Why would Loki even care about that?
No idea. But if he's free again, what happened to Melina? Did she let him go, or is she a crispy critter now? Or maybe Hel found them and threatened her, or paid her off or killed her. Who knows? Annoyed by the lack of answers, I looked up at the sky, assuming that Odin was looking in on us from Hlidskjalf.
"And hey, Odin, are you listening? I thought you were supposed to be keeping an eye on Loki since he's such a potential problem."
Granuel considered.
"The Finns had a thunder god, didn't they? Sort of like Perrin?"
"Yeah, I saw him once. His name is Ukko, which basically translates to old man, god of the sky and thunder. He was part of the crew that came to kill me in Arizona and instead hacked up Coyote into tiny pieces. He seemed a bit more laid back than the other thunder gods, though. Probably because the Finns are just cool like that. Want to guess where they say thunderstorms come from?"
"Oh, ew. I'm not sure, judging by the grin on your face."
"All that noise and precipitation gets made when Ukko and his wife Akka have thunderous sex. Isn't that awesome?" Granuel shook her head.
"No, it's gross. You are such a guy sometimes."
"Isn't he a guy all the time?"
She's not saying I'm occasionally female. She's implying that I'm shallow.
"Oh, I know. So why did she say only sometimes?"
"Hey!"
Granuel couldn't have heard what I said, but Oberon's comment, plus the outrage that must have shown on my face, caused her to laugh.
"Burn!"
"Good dog,"
she said, petting him.
"Well, I hope Ukko's all right," I said, steering the conversation back to safer territory. If indeed he was the target, and if this was Loki's doing.
"Ukko wanted you dead, and you're worried about his welfare?"
"Well, yeah, I guess. He also cheered when the Morrigan cut Vidar in half. I think he was more bored than truly angry with me. He tagged along for the entertainment value."
"If he calls ganging up on people and watching them die entertainment, I'm not predisposed to like him."
"A few of the old gods are truly friendly. Govnu is a notable exception."
"Don't forget Fand. She gave us both bacon and sausage."
Granuel brightened, agreeing with my hound.
"Yeah, I like Fand and Monadon MacLear. They tend to save our asses, so what's not to like?"
"Count them amongst the few, then," I said, and squinted west toward the sun, now low on the horizon. "You let me sleep a bit long, didn't you?"
"You needed it. I was just about to wake you."
Two large ravens swooped down from the sky and landed on the branch of an ash tree.
"Ah, Odin was watching us after all," I said, pointing at Hugin and Munin. "Perhaps we can get some answers."
In the mundane spectrum, I still couldn't tell them apart, but in the magical spectrum, they were easily distinguished now, since Hugin glowed with more magic as the mind of Odin. Hugin jerked his beak at Munin, indicating that I should bind my consciousness with his. Once I did so, Odin's memories caught me up with recent events. I saw Loki, still dazed by the charms of the Sisters of the Three Auroras,
specifically by Claudia's lips, to which I myself had succumbed once upon a time. They were decadent, sultry, so very, very kissable. And damn, they almost snared me through the replay. The witches and the god of mischief were still in the same field where we had left them, which surprised me to some extent. I had expected Melina to move the operation elsewhere, but perhaps she had decided that moving was more trouble than it was worth, and it's not as if onion fields are subject to constant scrutiny. The view expanded to show me Garm, Hell's gigantic hound, similarly entranced by a couple of other witches. I smiled appreciatively. With Garm occupied, Hell wouldn't know where to send her Draugr. Melina had done well. Garm's gaze was fixed on a stick held in front of his eyes by one of Melina's younger coven members. Clearly, it had been enchanted with the same beguiling charm they had used on their body parts to ensnare humans. With both Loki and Garm preoccupied, Garm being Hell's eyes and ears on Earth, much like Hugin and Munin often served as Odin's, Melina could conceivably stave off Ragnarok indefinitely, keeping Hell uncertain of victory. Provided, of course, she wasn't interrupted. Ukko provided the interruption. Somehow he discovered that Loki was unbound from his long imprisonment and located him, a mystery that begged to be solved since no one else had beaten him to it. Why was Ukko the first to discover this? He flew down from the sky, landed a short distance away, and, without so much as a howdy-do, threw lightning at Loki. His motivation wasn't a mystery at all. Like Perrin, who held an equivalent position among the old Rus tribes, the Finn would have very little love for the Norse pantheon, being a sort of direct competitor for the hearts and minds of people in that region of the world. Loki flew bodily through the air, his torso folded and his long, flailing limbs reminding me of a squid. He landed 50 yards away, far outside the range of Claudia's lips or Melina's hair or any other charm capable of calming him. His body bloomed in flames, and the madness returned.
"Huh? Who?"
he cried, then saw Ukko advancing.
"Thunder God! Good!"
Melina shouted something in Polish, but Loki and Ukko ignored it, focused as they were on each other. Loki took a deep breath in the way a trained opera singer would, chest rising faintly but lungs filling like a bellows. He threw back his head and roared as his hands flew up and an inferno exploded from him, a burning ring of fire that lifted Ukko off his feet and set the field alight. Here, then, was the great conflagration that Melina's coven had foreseen.
"Set your world on fire!"
Loki spat before launching himself into the air and streaking north, presumably toward Finland. Ukko, having no choice and forced to play defense, followed him without ever acknowledging, or perhaps even realizing, that he had flipped Loki's switch from neutralized to unchained sociopath. Odin's vision didn't chase after them, but rather panned back to the witches. They had their purple wards up, protected from the flames, but clearly feeling the heat. Garm, however, had no such protection. His fur was aflame, and he sprinted, howling for the river that bordered Yasuo's western edge, some 200 yards away. The witches ran after him, cursing in Polish and sounding far more angry than scared. Munin broke off the images and squawked at me. I disconnected with him and then switched to Hugin to speak with Odin. "All right, why was Ukko there?" I said. The Grey Wanderer's voice lacked the casual tone he'd employed when Loki was safely occupied. Even the Raven looked a bit more concerned.
"I was hoping you could tell me."
"Are you suggesting I had something to do with it? Not only would that be against my own interest, but I've been a little busy lately."
"Someone had to stir him to action. Ukko is not what one would call vigilant."
"Well, what about Hel?"
"She didn't know where he was. Her hound was ensnared by those witches. Besides, she wouldn't need to send anyone if she wished to free her father. She would have come herself and brought Draugr along, as she did when Loki invaded Nidavellir."
Maybe she just told Ukko that Loki was free and Ukko used his own methods.
Possible. Perhaps, Odin granted. But not really her style. This seems more like the sort of string pulling favored by the Tuatha De Danann, if you don't mind me saying.
Oh, right. Mir, I said.
Who?
I shared my suspicions about Mir's motivation to want me dead, and his relative ability to do it.
Interesting. This will set off a whole new round of betting in Valhalla.
This time, I didn't curb my tongue. The Einherjar can go toast their foreskins. Odin laughed at me.
I'll be sure to tell them.
Do. What happened to the witches in Garm?
The witches reached the river safely. Garm shifted to hell before he got there, so I assume he is recuperating now.
Great. One more thing to worry about.
Garm is of no concern at present, and neither is Hel. Loki is. He's burned out the Finns, and presumably he's now free to look for you. He'll scour the continent for you because of what you did to Fenris.
That reminds me, how is Freya doing? The Norse goddess of beauty and war had been severely injured in our raid on Hel.
Recuperating. Frigg is looking after her.
Does she even know we were successful?
I do not believe she has regained consciousness yet.
I frowned. Is she in a coma or something? I knew that she had lost a lot of blood and had some shattered bones when we evacuated her, but perhaps she'd suffered more head trauma than was immediately evident. Odin huffed impatiently.
I don't know. I haven't checked today. What you need to worry about is Loki's next target, and that's you. He'll want you dead before he starts Ragnarok. I think he sees you as a bigger threat than me right now. The best thing you can do, therefore, to delay the onset of the world's end is to make yourself scarce. Get off this plane.
Thanks, I said dryly. We've been working on that. Gotta go.
No, stay there.
Why?
There are dark elves on the way. You've remained in one place long enough for them to pinpoint your location.
Like I said, gotta go.
The Loselfar are coming too, and one other.
Who?
You've met.
The rainbow bridge from Asgard shimmered into existence on the pasture next to the long wood, and we saw distant forms in the sky growing larger. I broke my link with Hugin and turned to Granuaile. On your guard, dark elves coming, I said, and apparently some standard elves and a bonus dude to help us somehow. Oberon perked up.
Awesome. I've never seen a base model elf before. But they come with bonus dudes?
In this case, they do. Granuaile hefted Skawaja.
Going invisible, she said,
before speaking the binding and winking out. I cast camouflage on Oberon, but left myself visible. The Loselfar, when they stepped off Bifrost onto Midgard, both disappointed and delighted me. They weren't wearing leaf-shaped green and gold armor with curlicues or long robes with overlarge embroidered sleeves. They didn't glow with backlighting or come with their own soundtrack by Enya. Their hair wasn't long, straight, and silky, and their eyes weren't limpid pools of oh my god straight out of manga. But they were tall and slender and very shiny, and they sounded like wind chimes when they moved. The sound came from their light blue enamel armor. That is, glass fused to a metal base. It draped their forms in layered scales so that they reminded me of pangolins, if pangolins could blind you like metal mud flaps on a semi-truck. In the center of each enamel scale, a single rune had been etched with acid, and so far as I could tell, it was always the same rune. On a practical level, I couldn't imagine the benefit to enamel. Basic blunt force would shatter it, and the metal backing each scale looked to be either aluminum or a thin wafer of steel. But the runes must offer some protection. Their helmets had no metal backing. Each was a solid piece of shaped glass in light blue, etched with the same rune over and over, lending the impression that someone had found some defective fishbowls at an outlet store and shipped them all to Alfheim. A grid of thin holes had been drilled through the glass around the nose, mouth, and ears, which had the effect of blurring out those features, but otherwise I could see that their heads were closely cropped, and the tops of their ears did have the famous pointy cartilage. They had swords swinging on their left hips, but I wondered if they weren't ceremonial. Their primary weapons rested in holsters strapped to their thighs, large flechette pistols. 2 dozen such elves were led by a thick, diminutive fellow in heavy steel plate. His armor was also etched with runes, but these were many and varied and flickered with their own light. 4 small axes were strapped to his back, handles peeking over his shoulder. His voice was muffled somewhat by his helmet, but I still recognized the diction.
"I greet ye, Druid, Wolf Slayer, Freyr's Bane, Loki Shepherd. May ye walk from battle unbruised, and exult in the death songs of the slain."
There was only one person I knew who would assign me such epithets and string them together. "Fjallar? Is that you? Runeskald of Nidavellir?"
"The dwarf who made us nom-noms?"
Oberon said.
"Yes, I have come with the Glass Knights, the Losalfar elite, rune-warded and ready for battle, to meet the Svartalfar who pursue ye. Axes have I brought, newly forged and blazoned, to cut the smoky black and tear flesh out of vapor."
"What? I beg your pardon, but you lost me there." Fjallar drew one of the axes fixed to his back. It had a barb on the handle that triggered a release on the holder as he pulled it up so that the blade wouldn't get caught. Clever design. He pointed at the runes seared into the blade of the axe and said,
"These are experiments in craft and war, an attempt to cleave through magic mist and wound the flesh, to sunder smoke yet slice through bone and sinew."
"You're saying if you hack a dark elf in his smoke form with that, he'll show the wound when he turns solid?"
"I will not know until I attempt it, but it is my hope. The runes are supposed to end their vaporous state, and then the blade cuts them, which binds them to their solid form. Should any of the axes prove successful, more will I make and teach the craft and song to other rune scalds."
"That sounds fabulous," I said. "But what if none of the axes perform the way you hope they do?" The dwarf's armor twitched, signaling a shrug underneath all the steel.
"I will return to my forge and try anew."
"No, I mean, the dark elves are not going to allow you to experiment on them."
"They will have no choice in the matter."
"I mean, they're going to fight back."
"And the lamb will cry before it's slaughtered. There is no difference."
Fjallar's helmet twitched, indicating his eyes had been drawn elsewhere.
"Ah, see where they come. Remain here and do nothing until you are ordered to drop to the ground."
"I beg your pardon?"
"You need do nothing but attract them. Let us take care of this."
I cast my eyes across the pasture separating the long wood from the copse to the east and spied a sizable group of dark elves approaching, equal to the number of elves on our side. Dressed in what appeared to be shimmering white warm-up outfits that basketball teams favor, except with tunics instead of jerseys, they ran in an undisciplined mob until they saw Fjallar step forward, brandishing an axe. Responding to some unseen cue, they formed into a wedge and sped up, moving at double time. Behind me, the Glass Knights spread themselves into 6 half-squads of 4 elves each and drew their flechette pistols, 1 in each hand. Fjallar strode forward a few more paces until he was perhaps 20 yards in front of us. If anyone had been dressed in modern combat gear, I would have felt a bit silly standing there naked amongst all that armor. But aside from the flechette pistols, we were all rocking at old school, and I felt like a proper Celt. "You seriously don't want me to do anything?" I called.
"You will ruin our tactics if you do,"
the Runeskald replied over his shoulder. On the one hand, I felt a tad hurt that they didn't want my help, but on the other, I was happy to let them assume all the risk if they wanted it. I was also curious about how this would unfold. This was the most disciplined bunch of Dark Elves I had seen to this point, and, if I was not mistaken, they were carrying standard steel weapons because they had learned they couldn't pierce my aura with their magical knives. Oberon, I'd like you and Granuel to hang back behind the elves if you're not already doing so.
We are, but I'll tell Clever Girl.
With 30 yards to go until they reached Fjallar, the Dark Elves stopped and drew steel scimitars, holding them above their heads. They paused for a few beats, and then charged on a silent signal. Fjallar rushed to meet them, one dwarf against 25 Dark Elves, and he wasn't silent. He sang something fierce, and a yellow energy began to coalesce around his armor. When he met the point of the phalanx, his axe whiffed through the clothes and smoke of the point man, as the rest of the wedge flowed to either side and flanked him, their swords arcing down onto his armor. Their blades rebounded away from his helmet and pauldrons as if they were rubber, and made clunking noises instead of an expected clang. Yellow light exploded at each contact. Fjallar swung again with his axe, slicing ineffectually through smoke. I suppose he'd managed to make a few of them drop their standard weapons, and his armor had clearly been enchanted to withstand their blows, but neither side was doing any damage. Undaunted, Fjallar dropped his first axe and drew another one. While he reached back, the point man solidified, nude, and stabbed at him with the black knife that all Svartalfar carried. This weapon rebounded as well. And when Fjallar hacked at him with his new axe, the villain evaded it again by turning incorporeal. Some of the Dark Elves moved beyond Fjallar, reformed a smaller wedge, and charged up the slope at me, their true target. They all still had gleaming steel in their hands. Seeing this, one of the Loselfar barked a command in Old Norse, and the elves raised their weapons, but no one ordered me to get down. I readied Fragorah and cast a final worried glance at Fjallar. He was drawing his third axe, bellowing his scald and snarling at his opponents, who continued to rain down blows as useless as his own, until he swung at them with the third axe. As before, the Dark Elves dissolved to coal-black smoke in advance of his blow. But this time, when the axe passed through, it seemed to pull and rip them into solid form as it moved through the air, the way a zipper will part and reveal something hidden in its journey downward. And the Dark Elves, who had been so torn back into the world, were split by the axe, and inky innards slithered out of their torsos onto the earth.
"Victory!"
Fjallar shouted, and the Loselfar leader behind me commanded that I get down. The Dark Elves in front of me were awfully close, but I dropped to the earth in curiosity. And so did Fjallar. The elves began to shoot their flechettes in a prescribed pattern at the Dark Elves in set intervals. Once every half second, though it took me a couple of seconds to realize it and understand the strategy. The first volley caught some of the Dark Elves unawares, but most saw it coming and dissolved, dropping their steel in the process. The subsequent shots passed above my head and threw them without harm, but that wouldn't continue. The Dark Elves could maintain their incorporeal forms for only 5 seconds, so the Loselfar just needed to spray the field with flechettes for 6, and they would catch all of them solid at some point. 4 seconds in, one of the Svartalfar materialized at my side with his black knife held high. He was blown away before he could bring it down. Others saw that the Loselfar were a threat and took shape behind them. But when the Dark Elves lunged in for the kill, the runes on the glass armor activated and repulsed them with a blue shockwave that sent them staggering backward. And then, in the 5th second, the ones below in the field all had to beef up, and they were hit by a double volley of flechettes. The first rocked them and anchored them to flesh, and the second mowed them down. The stragglers behind the line of glass knights, only 3, melted away and fled.
"I want to see that again in slow motion."
Fjallar and I rose from the ground and stepped away from the mess of Dark Elf corpses, before their inherent instability caused them to melt and turn to an oily goo.
"Did you see that, Druid?" the Runeskald crowed. "The Order of Runes triumphs over evil."
"Well, yeah, I guess. What happened there?"
"The third axe worked. Now that I know the proper runes and scald to use, I can create more such weapons and arm the glass knights for their mission, honor bathed and glory steeped.
I'm sorry, what mission?
Our kings, Arvang and Gedelglen, have decreed it should be so. Deep into Svartalfheim the glass knight shall delve, wreaking ruin and smiting those who would oppose us during Ragnarok.
Something didn't compute. Hold on, how do you know who will oppose you during Ragnarok? Have the Svartalfar said they would fight with Hel?
Is this not proof enough, Druid?
Fjallar said, gesturing at the field where the Dark Elves were dissolving into tar. No, it's not. These are clearly assassins or mercenaries in someone's employ, but they do not represent the hearts of all the Svartalfar. There may be some who would oppose Hel, and if so, they would be valuable allies. Fjallar growled and yanked off his helmet with his left hand. His chin was still bald, and his hair in braids, in accordance with his culture's mourning practices. He stepped up to me.
Are ye such a good judge of character now? You, who sent Loki Firehands to Nidavellir to kill thousands of my shield brothers.
I didn't send him there to kill anyone. He did that without my urging, and you know it. But what does Odin say about this plan to invade Svartalfheim?
Did he not tell you to wait for our arrival? Did he not send us here on the Bifrost Bridge? Is that not Bifrost even now waiting to take us back to Asgard?
He said, pointing behind me. The Rainbow Bridge shimmered in the late afternoon sun.
What am I doing, arguing with a nude man?
He groused, stalking past me and attempting to stalk on the rainbow too, except that it wasn't the sort of surface that allowed stalking. The Glass Knights turned and followed, denying me any more time to discuss the matter. I frowned after them because it was a disturbing development. I wasn't a particular fan of the Dark Elves, but that was only because I hadn't met any nice ones yet. From what Manannan MacLir had told me, some of the Svartalfar had nobility in their nature. They tended to be the ones who didn't take mercenary contracts.
Odin! Are you on board with this?
I shouted. The bridge retracted without an answer, though I hardly expected one.
Anakish, those last three Dark Elves didn't really go away for good.
Interesting. Where are they?
Behind you, picking up steel swords from the ground.
Thanks. Tell Granuel she can fire at will. I turned around and raised Fragoraw in time to see three Dark Elves with scimitars loping my way, wearing grim expressions and nothing else. I winced when one of Granuel's knives sank into the groin of the leader, and he went down screaming and clutching the ruins of his junk. I'm going to have nightmares.
Word!
The remaining two Svartalfar whiffed into the air, anticipating more knives from an invisible assailant, but Granuel stayed her hand. Their steel dropped to the ground, and I pursued one of the clouds, swishing Fragoraw through it, thinking I would catch him as he turned solid. I missed high. Sensing what I was up to, his substance dropped to the ground and he solidified, where he promptly swept my legs and blocked the wild swing I made, with his forearm staying my wrist. His right hand poked me in quick sequence along pressure points across my chest and froze up my muscles. Where the hell had he learned that? But then it was easy for him to pin my sword arm and wrap his other hand around my throat. His buddy came back, retrieved a scimitar, and took two steps with a mind to finish me, before a throwing knife abruptly sprouted from his chest. It didn't kill him, but its appearance caused him to focus on prolonging his own life rather than ending mine. Oberon jumped on him and ended it. At least, that's what I think happened, judging by the growl and the takedown. Granuel wouldn't have growled. She would have clocked him upside the head with her staff, which is what she did to the fellow choking me. She put a whole lot of energy behind that swing, because his head exploded like a melon, and he slumped on me, leaking black blood.
Thanks, I gasped. I was just about to take care of him, but yeah, you know, I was good.
Grainuel dispelled her invisibility and kicked the dark elf off me before kneeling at my side.
Did he paralyze you or something?
Partially. I'm working on it. The muscles were locked up, and I had to patiently relax them, one fiber at a time.
That's Far Eastern super-secret martial arts, isn't it? Where did a dark elf learn that?
In the Far East, I expect, just like I learned a few things there. We don't know how long these guys live or what access they have to instruction, but it shouldn't be a shock to discover that they're well-trained. We've managed to surprise them a few times, and I think these glass knights are something new to them as well, but they're equally capable of surprising us. I'd seen plenty of the dark elves get taken out in ambushes so far, but I reflected that I hadn't done too well against them in head-to-head combat. They were extraordinarily fast and strong, and if I hadn't had Granuel's help a couple of different times, they would have snuffed me. It would be better to avoid future conflict, or even have them fight on our side. I'd rather get to whoever's sending them after my ass than meet any more of them.
I hear that, but let me speak a word into your ear. Clothes.
Yeah, we should get some. No one takes you seriously when you're naked.
That's wisdom right there. Hold on, I'm going to get my knives.
The first Svartalf she'd hit had bled to death, and his hands were still cupped around his groin. I turned my head away so I didn't have to watch her yank out the knife, but the sound it made caused me to cross my legs. His body turned to a sticky puddle as Granuel stepped away and wiped her blade clean on the grass. I was capable of free movement after another few minutes, and we jogged through the long wood toward a road called Hosey Hill. I took note of the birds in the wood and paused to watch them.
"What's up?"
Granuel asked, seeing my gaze directed at the treetops. "Augury, if we're lucky. We're due for some luck, don't you think? I'm not a proponent of augury as a rule, but since I have no other methods of divination available to me, I'll take what I can get." Granuel flicked her eyes upward, tracking the finches flitting around in the branches.
"What are you aiming to get out of all that noise?"
I sat on a thin carpet of leaves and kept my eyes on the birds. A guess about our pursuit. How long before the huntresses catch up? She sat next to me and rested her staff across her lap.
"You never taught me how to do that."
"I rarely use it. I prefer casting wands because it's quicker and you can ask multiple questions. With augury, you have to wait and observe for about 15 minutes per question and hope you didn't miss something."
"Can I sniff these trees while you're doing whatever you're doing?"
Oberon asked. "Sure, buddy. Just don't bark at anything." Oberon trotted off, and I spent the next 15 minutes trying to guess the future according to the behavior of the 10 or so birds I could see frolicking above us. The theory behind augury was akin to chaos theory, in that actions in one place can have profound effects elsewhere, and birds were acutely sensitive to changes in their environment. They could anticipate storms and dry spells and figure when it was best to migrate. Thus, if one was properly schooled in how to interpret their behavior, one might be able to tap into their sense of the future. These birds would see not only me pass underneath them, but the huntresses as well. The question was when. I wasn't sure I caught everything that their fluttering and pecking order had to tell me, but my best guess was that once we made it to Windsor Forest, we'd have a few hours to kill before dawn, and the huntresses would get there shortly after sunrise. In camouflage, we resumed our run, following Hosey Hill north to Westerham. I washed off the remains of the dark elf in a public fountain, and then we entered an Orvis store, a kind of outdoorsy UK chain, just before close of business. I found a black Havana shirt and jeans and declared myself satisfied. There was no use finding any shoes. It was the next best thing to camouflage when running at night. Vowing to pay them back when we could, we exited, dropped our bindings, and allowed ourselves to be seen. Granuel had found an all-black training outfit, a form-hugging kit that would let her move silently without restriction, as long as she didn't wear the noisy windbreaker that came with it. She stuck to the running tank, proudly displaying the full tattoos on her right arm. Granuel's eyes roved up and down.
"Druid is the new black," she said.
"Did you just make a yummy sound?"
Yes, and I would like to point out that she didn't do that when you were nude.
Chapter 21. We floated onto the grounds of Windsor Park like shades, unnoticed in the dark of night. On Snow Hill, 2 miles to the south of the castle, we paused by the statue of George III, which gave us a view of the long walk to the castle, tree-lined and coiffed according to royal wishes. "See this guy?" I said, my hand slapping against the stone of the pedestal. Not only did he lose the American colonies and usher in the twilight of the British Empire, but he pulled down Hearn's Oak back in the 18th century. It was already dead, so I guess that was some excuse, but I can't help thinking it was kind of a dick move. But there are still oaks there to this day, replanted by this monarch or that. We should be able to go there and call him.
"Atticus, these oaks you speak of, are they, off-limits?"
Well, it might be wise to refrain from marking them. Hearn had a whole pack of hounds. They might take issue with you claiming their trees as your own.
"But they're dead, right? So what's the big deal?"
"Not sure, but it's best to be polite."
"How do we call Hearn exactly?"
Granuel asked. "We'll ask Albion to help us out." I did my best to sound confident. In truth, I didn't know how we were supposed to call him or how he could possibly help us against two immortals. The Morgan's assurance that Hearn could help us somehow seemed hollow now that she was dead, and we'd been unable to do anything to the Olympians except inconvenience them. But I knew he was for real. Just before the whole business with Angus Oak exploded, Flitish had come to visit me with a warning, and she casually mentioned that she'd been guesting in Hearn's forest. She wouldn't have called it that if Hearn weren't a force to be reckoned with. She would have called it a forest in Albion, or perhaps simply Windsor Forest. Like most of the world, Windsor Great Park used to be wild, but its size had dwindled over the centuries to the present 4,800 protected acres. North of Frogmore House, which was itself a bit south of the castle, lay the historical location of Hearn's death. The oak that had been pulled down on the orders of King George III had been replanted by King Edward VII. It was there I would attempt to call him. I didn't know much about Hearn, having never met him. I'd heard the same legends as everyone else. The attempts to explain his existence were many and varied. In the view of some, he was a corrupted form of the horned god Cernunnos, or perhaps a twist on Odin, who also led a form of the Wild Hunt and had experience hanging from trees. Many of these theories had something to do with Hearn's penchant for wearing antlers and connecting dots between the name Hearn and old words for horn. To others, he was an historical figure, a ranger or gamekeeper for one of the old kings, led by disgrace of some kind to hang himself and haunt the woods ever after. Shakespeare gave him a shout-out in The Merry Wives of Windsor, but he didn't lay down the definitive legend so much as give Hearn a different kind of immortality. We padded down the grass from Snow Hill into the row of trees lining the eastern side of the long walk, where puffy strands of mist clung to the trunks like torn cotton balls. Some insects buzzed and an owl hooted, but otherwise the only sound was our soft footfalls on the turf. We veered to the northeast, across trimmed expanses of grass to the slightly more verdant grounds of Frogmore House, a sometime residence for members of the royal family. A serpentine pond wound behind it, with plenty of willows weeping on the banks and hedges growing to please the gardener who loved them. We must have tripped a passive security alarm on our way across, because a couple of guards with flashlights and guns came looking for us. The flashlights told us right where the guards were, and Granuel and I decided to mess with them a bit. Approaching in camouflage, we snatched their guns and chucked them into the pond.
"Bloody hell!" one shouted.
A trip, a takedown, and a druid doomhold later, and they were both sleeping peacefully on the exquisite back lawn.
"They had guns,"
Granuel remarked. It was somewhat unusual for security in the UK.
"But I guess they weren't MI6.
"No, they were pretty low rent. Means the royals aren't here. That's good." The few oaks north of Frogmore were truly magnificent, even if they looked a bit lonely in the too tidy landscape of Home Park. We were in a restricted area now, but had already subdued the closest security. Thick trunks and wide, strong branches formed impressive canopies, and in the mist they managed to take on a slight character of menace. Despite this, they were as susceptible to the ravages of pandemonium as the rest of the world's trees. I hoped the efforts of the Olympians wouldn't prevent Hearn from appearing now. His specific tree, or rather the big tree that was supposedly planted in the precise spot of the original, was circled by an iron fence that bore a plaque linking it to supernatural history. Druid requires aid, I sent to Albion. Request, contact Hearn, old steward of this place. Express our wish to meet.
Done, Albion replied. Soon he will come.
Oh, I said aloud. That was fast.
What?
Granuel asked. Apparently, Albion has a direct line to Hearn. That intrigued me. I was curious to know if Albion granted Hearn any of his magic, or if Hearn was living like the gods, suckling at the magical teat of belief. If it was the latter, then it was a highly localized belief. He should be coming soon, but I don't know from where. I doubted he would ride in from the north, where there was a golf course now. We scanned the landscape around us until Granuel spotted something moving to the south, and she chucked my right shoulder to point behind me.
Over there, I think.
Even with night vision, it was difficult to see. She was pointing at something that had detached itself from the shadow of a veteran oak tree, even more ancient than the one marked as Hearn's. Behind it, several other somethings moved. The figures brightened as they got closer. That is to say, they took on a minimal albedo, reflecting moonlight and providing faint outlines. There were three men on horses and hounds walking alongside. The figure in the center had a large rack of antlers floating over his head, but his features were largely occluded by a hooded cloak. Part of me wondered how he'd managed to pull a hood over those antlers, and added that there was no good reason for a ghost to wear a cloak or anything at all, but another part reasoned that one of the few perks of being an unhoused spirit must be the ability to wear impractical clothing for effect. The riders became clearer as they approached, but it wasn't merely a function of shrinking distance. They were becoming brighter, flaring into luminosity as the spirits manifested fully. The horses and hounds were supposed to be black, according to legend, but in the light of the moon and their own ghostly glow, perhaps aided by a certain transparency, they took on more of a midnight blue color. Hearn rode in leathers of the hunt. His eyes, visible under his hood once he drew near, lacked pupils. They were holes made of lambent cobalt. The bottom half of his face billowed with a dark thicket of a beard. Trimming it would require pruning shears. The antlers were quite imposing up close, and taken together with his face and disturbing eyes, they suggested what Bambi's dad would look like if he ever decided to kick the ass of anyone who dared to be stupid in his forest. His companions lacked headgear, but their eyes and beards were of a kind with Hearn's. Evidently, men's grooming products had yet to penetrate the spectral market. Hearn looked first at me, then at Granuel.
"Which is the druid?"
I blinked and was slow to reply. I'd been kind of expecting to hear something raspy and whispery out of his throat, or something choked with phlegm, the way ghosts always seem to sound when they vocalize in popular entertainment. But Hearn spoke in a perfectly clear baritone. In Middle English. If he used short, simple sentences, he could probably make himself understood to a speaker of modern English. But longer sentences would be difficult for contemporary speakers to decode, since half the vowels would be pronounced differently. Amongst the tales of him that purported to be historical, this fact suggested that he was much more likely to have been a subject of Richard II than of Henry VIII.
"Did he ask which was the druid? We're both druids,"
Granuel said. Hearn's brow furrowed at first, perhaps trying to process Granuel's modern pronunciation, but then it smoothed out and his mouth quirked up on the left side.
"Both of you?"
"Is he okay?"
Granuel asked. "Yes, it's Middle English," I said.
"Did Middle English hound bark with an extra syllable on the end? Like, woofie?"
I ignored Oberon's question and addressed Hearn. "Aye, bothe."
And druids be, then he answer me, whose love in ire is most fine and fray.
Did he just rhyme on purpose?
Grunuel whispered. I replied in kind, though Hearn could easily hear us. Yes, it's a riddle in verse. If I can't answer in the same fashion, then I'm not the old druid I claim to be, and I'm trespassing here. Even though Albion's obviously told him I'm a druid, it's a sort of challenge.
Do you know the answer?
Of course he does. It's bacon. Bacon is the answer to everything.
Oberon had a point.
Why are we here?
Bacon. But that wasn't the kind of answer Hearn needed. He wanted to hear the name of an old hunting partner with a legendary libido, so I said,
Whether in beddy or in field do ye meet, Flidish awaiteth your limus to greet.
At this, laughter erupted from the ghost to the point where one of the hunters started coughing uncontrollably, which I thought completely bizarre since he no longer had a pulmonary system.
Wait, Grunuel said. Flidish isn't funny. I missed the joke. Why was that funny?
The easy grins of the hunters faded, replaced with a look of discomfort. If I explain it to you, then it won't be. Grunuel noticed that the hunters now looked a bit embarrassed.
Do it anyway.
In Middle English, when referring to a man, a limb was a euphemism for a penis, and the verb gretten didn't simply mean hello. It had a rather strong connotation of a sexual embrace. So I'm sorry to say I was being a bit crude.
Ooh.
Perhaps more than a bit. Grunuel's mouth tightened in prim disapproval, and she turned narrowed eyes on the hunters. One began to inspect his boots, and the other found something fascinating up in the sky. Hearn abruptly decided that now would be a good time to pet his horse. They might speak Middle English, but it appeared they could follow modern well enough, and Grunuel's body language needed no translation.
I know all you boys are old school,
she said, waving her finger around to include me while looking at the hunters.
But let's try to remember what century this is, shall we? Any ass you can kick, I can kick better, and so can Flidish.
Aye,
Hearn barked, and glared at his men as if they had been the only ones laughing. Then he turned to us, smiled, and said,
Honored druids, you're welcome to my forest.
His old diction sloughed away.
I have learned to speak modern English over the years, so be at ease. You are my guests. Hunt or rest as it pleases you.
Once he called us his guests, I finally understood what the Morrigan intended. Hearn would take little to no convincing to join our side. His honor, his raison d'etre, demanded that he protect both his forest and his guests. Is my hound a guest as well? He likes to hunt with us.
Aye, he is.
I thanked him and said, It is more likely that we will be hunted than have time to hunt anything else. Hearn's friendly smile disappeared.
Hunted? By whom?
Olympians. At least one is plaguing Albion even now, either Pan or Faunus.
The goat-footed god? He has passed through here recently.
And because of that, we cannot shift to Tir na n'Og. He spreads pandemonium and upsets the Order of Gaia, distresses the forest. He keeps us here so that Artemis and Diana can slay us. Hearn scowled, and the cobalt eyes flared brighter for a moment. He dismounted and squatted, pressing the fingers of one hand into the earth. I noted that this process made no noise whatsoever. No creak of leather, no thump of foot on the forest floor. He and his companions made noise only when they wished to. After a few seconds of contemplation, Hearn said,
It's true. It's not visible, but it can be felt. The goat disturbs my forest.
He looked up at me.
And they come to hunt my guests?
Aye, and it is not only your forest they disturb, but all forests in Albion.
It shall not stand,
Hearn vowed, rising.
My guests are few, and none have dared trespass on my good will for some time. No one attempts to hunt my forest anymore.
It was more likely due to protections laid down by the Crown Estate than anything else, but if Hearn wished to believe it was due to his badassery, I wouldn't disabuse him of the notion.
If any attempt it now, they shall feel my wrath. Rest now, and recover your strength. Should Olympians appear to despoil my forest, day or night, we will ride!
My thanks. Forgive my ignorance, but do you have power to wound the corporeal? Hearn stared at me in silence for a time, unable to believe I'd asked him, but then withdrew a knife from a sheath at his belt. It was barely visible, and its outlines were suggested only by reflected light. Stepping forward slowly, he raised it casually and pressed the point into my chest, just enough to draw blood.
"Do you feel its bite?"
he growled.
"Yes. Fair enough. I am answered."
He nodded, a rather dangerous gesture when one is sporting antlers, and returned the knife to its sheath. I triggered my healing charm to close up the small wound. One of Hearn's hunters spoke up suddenly, his voice surprisingly high and nasal and amused.
"Ha! What means your hound to sniff thus?"
he said. Hearn and I turned our heads to discover Oberon with his nose snuffling at the rear end of a bewildered ghost hound. I sighed.
"Oberon, you're embarrassing me."
"Huh?"
Oberon grunted. He raised his snout and swung his head around to look at me.
"Can you believe this, Atticus? Scentless asses. What would they think of next?"
Chapter 22. Together we left the home park and ran southwest to the proper Windsor Forest, which was only a mile or two long these days. On the northeastern side of it, there was an amusement park, which struck me as an odd juxtaposition. To a druid, the forest was the amusement park. Hearn left us near the edge of a field in the middle of it, far from prying eyes, and told us he and his hunters would leave us for now.
"Again, you're welcome. Call my name if you need me,"
he said.
"Otherwise, rest or prepare yourselves as you will."
We thanked him, and he faded out of sight as slowly as he had originally appeared. As soon as they were gone, Oberon flopped onto his back and said,
"The royal hound's belly demands rubbing. Sip lively, humans, neglect me not."
Granuel laughed and knelt next to him to oblige. I smiled and took a look around. This wood was a comfortable place. Not sensual comfort of any kind, merely a quiet spot where we could repair and nurture those parts within us that had been damaged or neglected during the run. I approached an old beech tree twined with ivy, plucked a couple of strands, and plonked myself down on the ground next to Granuel and Oberon. My hound twisted his head to see what I had in my hands.
"What are you going to do with that?"
"Arts and crafts," I replied.
"So you'll be at it for a while?"
"I guess so."
"Good. Thanks, Granuel. The belly is sated."
He rolled over and pulled himself closer to me without getting up. Using my lap as a pillow for his giant head, he stretched himself out on his side and sighed in contentment.
"Ah, nap time."
Granuel shook her head.
"You slept all day."
"Not all of it. We woke before sundown, and now it's, after sundown. So there."
She smiled, got to her feet, and then addressed me.
"What are we going to do now?"
"Relax while we can. There are a few hours before dawn."
"Shouldn't we be preparing to meet two very pissed off huntresses, building booby traps or something like that?"
"Probably. But there is some time to be creative. Or at least some time that I can steal, and so I'm going to take it. Ever notice how you never have time to do something until you decide that you do?" Granuel peered at the twisted strands of ivy in my hands and looked doubtful that they could serve as anything beyond compost. "Come on, sit back down for a sec." I patted the ground next to me, on the side where Oberon wasn't stretched out. She sighed and sat in the indicated spot, resting her staff on the ground. I smiled at her. "There, isn't this nice?" She looked at the canopy above, with the moon peeking through the leaves, and listened to the soft whisper of the night from grasses in the nearby field.
I can't argue the point. It's lovely.
Gaia has left us wonder wherever we go, if we only open our eyes to it.
Oh, I agree.
Now, I know I am not much of a craftsman, I said, busily knotting the vines into a circle, but greatness is in the act of creation and not necessarily in the finished product. Creating is the yin to the yang of our consumption, and the doorway to beauty that we all want to walk through. Creating is how I tell the world I love it. I handed the completed wreath to Granuaile, and she smiled as she took it.
You're very sneaky, you know?
Am I? She placed the ivy wreath on her head.
I thought you were being philosophical, and then you pivoted to mushy.
I have +20 verbal dexterity. Granuaile leaned in for a kiss, but Oberon interrupted.
Stop now, or I will yak on your lap.
We were saved from both yak and further mush by the arrival of Flittish, who called to us from the small field and revealed herself when our eyes followed her voice.
Well met, druids.
Her tone mocked us gently.
Is it safe to approach?
She stood in her chariot, nearly identical to that of the Olympians in that it was pulled by stags. It wasn't a flashy design, more utilitarian than anything else. I'm not sure how she had muffled the noise of her movement. We should have heard her coming. Or perhaps I'd been simply too absorbed in Granuaile. I beckoned her over, and we all rose from the ground to meet her, Oberon grumbling about naps he'd never get back. I cautioned him to keep his thoughts to himself, since Flittish could hear him if she wished. She was dressed for battle. That is, she had her standard hunting leathers and bow and quiver, but she also wore 2 long daggers for close work. One I had seen before, but had thought it was purely ceremonial, for appearances at the Fey Court. Its handle was made of malachite and mother of pearl. Her hair bounced on her head in curly red ringlets, and she appeared to be in a good mood, which put me on my guard. Though I currently thought Mir was behind all this, Flittish had shown herself in the past to be a willing pawn of Briet's. I doubted she was truly our adversary, but neither did I trust her. How did you get here, if you don't mind me asking? I said as she approached. The tethers are all shut down by pandemonium. The huntress shrugged.
I used an old way.
I blinked. It wasn't guarded?
No. Why would it be?
Because they're all guarded or destroyed, all across Europe.
Not the one I used.
Where is it? I asked, because I couldn't remember any in this vicinity.
Underneath Windsor Castle, down amongst the earth left over from the days of William the Conqueror. It emerges in the dungeon, or basement, or whatever they call it these days. Is it catacombs?
It was probably the cellar, I advised her. How long ago did you use it?
Only minutes ago. I traveled directly here because I was informed by Odin's messenger that you were in some dire need.
Our dire need is to get off this plane. We have to escape the Olympians.
Ah, yes. I've heard you provoked them somehow, and the Morrigan is dead as a result. What did you do?
I put Bacchus on one of the Time Islands. Flittish rolled her eyes.
That would do it. And for that, the Morrigan is slain.
Her comment stung, and I knew it would settle into a corner of my mind and leap out at me from time to time, stinging me anew, but I pretended that I felt nothing. Can you take us to the old way? The expression of amusement faded.
Oh, I suppose.
What's the matter?
When I received your message from Odin, I was rather hoping you'd asked me here to help you fight the Olympians.
If there wasn't a way to avoid the fight altogether, that's precisely what I would be asking, since you know this area better than anyone, with the possible exception of Hearn. But I don't relish standing toe-to-toe with the true immortal. I'd rather withdraw and try diplomacy. Flittish snorted.
The Olympians are not diplomatic, or haven't you noticed? They talk through their differences only when killing isn't the best option. Unless you can give them a good reason to let you live, you're alive just until they catch up. or as long as I'm fighting on your side.
Ignoring her last comment, I said, I might be able to think of something if we can get them to listen. Escaping the plane would take killing us off the table. They'd have to talk. Through intermediaries, of course.
You'd rather run?
Scorn thickened Flitish's voice as she flirted with calling me a coward.
They are on our turf, or as close to our turf as we're likely to get. Let us show them what the Irish think of their arrogance. We have some time to prepare. My divination says the Olympians are on their way, but won't be here until after dawn. We can give them a fight and win.
It was gratifying to hear that her divination corroborated the evidence of my augury, but I said, I prefer to live up to the fighting Irish stereotype only when I'm cornered or when the odds are skewed in my favor. There's no upside to taking them on, Flitish. They're as fast as we are, if not faster. And, as you pointed out, they killed the Morrigan.
But because it was 2-1, correct?
I nodded, though I doubted it was true. From what I could tell, the Morrigan held them off and conducted a mental conversation with me for precisely as long as she wished. She died only when she stopped trying to live.
We can do the same thing to them,
Flitish assured me.
One by one, use the strategy their Roman puppet favored so much. Divide and conquer.
Or, I thought, you could be pretending to help us now, and then you'll quietly sit back and do nothing while Artemis and Diana hunt us down. There was no proof Flitish wasn't the one scheming against us, other than my vague inclination to view her as one who participated in the schemes of others rather than initiating them herself. But I voiced a different thought. Why are you so anxious to meet them in battle? Might you have a personal agenda? Flitish scoffed.
I have never met them, so I don't know what that could be.
You're essentially the same goddess, except that they're virgins and you're not. Maybe you're trying to prove that chastity is overrated.
That's self-evident, Atticus,
Granuel pointed out.
Or at least is to everyone who's enjoyed a good diddle.
She knows what I mean, I said. Perhaps Flitish is seeking validation that she's better than the Olympians instead of pursuing the strategically wiser option. She wouldn't be able to dance around calling me a coward if I turned her eagerness for battle into self-aggrandizement. Narrowing her eyes at me, Flitish let out a slow hiss of breath before saying,
All right, let's go to the old way.
She waved at her chariot.
Follow, and I'll take you there.
Hold on, I said. How did you get that chariot and team up through the cramped cellar of Windsor Castle?
I didn't.
She flicked a finger at her ride.
This is but one of many chariots I keep hidden throughout the aisles. The stags live in the area and came when I called.
That was far more sensible than what the Olympians were doing. But then again, they couldn't shift planes the way Flitish could, so it would make little sense for them. We followed Flitish through the damp mist of the dark before dawn, the air like wet cloth on our faces. As we loped at an easy pace through the park, we stayed alert for any sign of the Olympians, or for any sign of betrayal. We received a sign before we reached the castle. A dull thump pounded the air a half mile ahead of us, and a faint shockwave buffeted our faces soon afterward. We stopped running and watched a pale cloud of dust rise into the sky. It wasn't difficult to discern the source. I hoped no one had been in residence. Granuel said,
Was that?
An explosion. Yeah.
Big bada boom.
We turned to Flitish and she shook her head.
It wasn't me.
I didn't say.
Speech wasn't necessary. You think I arranged the destruction of the old way to keep us here?
No, I don't. But someone else did. Someone from Tir na n'Og. Do you have any idea who might be responsible or who might have ordered such a thing? Flitish whirled on me with a flash of anger in her eyes.
Just what is it that you suspect of me?
There was quite a long list, but voicing my suspicions would be counterproductive. I chose my words with care, leaving her little room to take offense or to escape telling me something useful. I suspect nothing, but I wonder plenty. If you have no ideas regarding who might have blown up part of Windsor Castle to prevent us using the old way to get back, then we are dealing with someone extremely clever. Who, amongst the Tuatha De Danann, would be able to arrange an explosion on this plane less than an hour after you used it? Or, more to the point, who was following you in Tir na n'Og and saw you leave that particular way? Flitish frowned at my last sentence. The idea that she might have been followed disturbed her more than anything else. The challenge faded from her eyes, and she looked away, considering the problem.
I suppose Ogma could have done it. His designs have been inscrutable for a long while.
The thought chilled me, but had occurred to me before. Granuel gasped, because it hadn't occurred to her. Flitish continued.
But Mir has been keeping to himself recently. He has a mind for such things. And he is a patron of that Fey Lord you shamed during your visit to court, the one in charge of the Rangers. What did you call him?
Lord Grundlebeard.
That's it.
What's his real name?
I never knew it. The irony is that no one ever paid attention to him until you singled him out for ridicule. Everyone calls him Grundlebeard now.
Bollocks. Now we don't have any choice but to stay and fight.
It is the best course, Druid. Your pardon. At court, you were always Sheehan, but I know you use other names outside it. Do you still go by Atticus, or do you have a new name?
Atticus is fine.
Maybe you should change it to Schwoony McMushypants.
Granuel choked back a laugh, and then coughed to mask her amusement, while Flitish's lips pursed in an effort not to smile. She'd heard Oberon's comment, too. All right, where do you recommend we fight? I asked, pretending my hound hadn't said anything. Not near the castle, I hope. That's going to be flooded with British security in short order. In fact, I bet we're on a satellite camera right now, and someone's going to be reviewing this and wondering who the hell we are. We should stay underneath the canopy and maybe go invisible for a while. Flitish scowled at the sky.
I have heard of these satellites. Perfidious creatures.
I didn't question her word choice, and neither did Granuel or Oberon. Now was not the time to explain orbital surveillance to a being who had yet to use a computer or cell phone. Satellites to her were as magical as the Fey were to humans.
Yes, we will return to the forest and sort ourselves for a defense.
Helicopters and distant sirens sounded behind us as we turned our backs on Windsor Castle and jogged through the home park toward Windsor Forest again. Once underneath the canopy, we dropped our camouflage and returned to the small clearing in the middle of the forest. Three marijuana plants grew nervously on the western perimeter, seemingly aware that they didn't belong there, dreading the day when they would be harvested and smoked by a bearded and half-baked local.
What's the plan, Atticus?
Still working on it, actually. Flitish left her chariot and stags plainly visible just underneath the trees, a clear signal that she was now involved in doing a bit of hunting of her own. We entered the forest together from the northwestern side of the clearing, creating one trail, but after about 100 yards, we decided to split up our forces.
Before we do, however,
Flitish said,
we might be able to take advantage of something.
She stared at Granuel while she said this, and Granuel understandably grew wary.
What did you have in mind?
She asked.
Have you taught her how to modify the camouflage binding, Atticus?
The huntress said. The correct answer would be yes, if I wished to avoid looking clueless. But since I truly was clueless, there was no use pretending. I didn't know it could be modified. It's one of the base spells tattooed into our skin.
You can't modify the base spell, of course, but you can add your own flourishes on top of it. I'm surprised you haven't tried it.
I'm full of surprises. And I didn't know why she was speaking of camouflage when Granuel had the ability to turn fully invisible.
Yes,
the goddess smirked, her eyes taking in Granuel's clothes.
Well, I have noticed that Granuel and I could be mistaken for twins if we made a little bit of an effort. That could give us an advantage, so allow me to make the effort.
I'd noticed the resemblance before, as had others. Ogma had mistaken Granuel for Flitish once while we were visiting Tir na n'Og. Keeping her eyes on Granuaile, Flitish began to speak a binding in Old Irish. I recognized the words for camouflage at the beginning, but she kept speaking past the point where it should have ended, targeting Granuaile's black outfit and reflecting it onto her own clothing before energizing the binding. Her hunting leathers all turned black.
"Whoa!"
Granuaile and I said in stereo. Oberon shuddered.
"I just got chills. Coming soon on BBC One, The Dark Druids of Windsor."
Flitish removed the bracer on her left arm, which protected her skin from the lash of her bowstring. That gave her the same sleeveless look as Granuaile.
"All right, hair next,"
the huntress said, for that was a significant difference. The color was almost identical, but Flitish had quite a bit more curl and frizz to hers than Granuaile did, and it made her look a bit like an 80s rocker.
"Maybe if we tie it up in a knot,"
Granuaile said.
"Yes, but first I need to straighten."
Flitish improvised a binding that had simply never occurred to me, or to Granuaile either, and the kinks smoothed out until her hair lay flat and wavy like Granuaile's.
"Great big bears, Atticus. Think of how much money she could make in Hollywood. Speak some gibberish, and you get Oscar-night hairdos in 5 minutes."
"Amazing,"
Granuaile said, smiling.
"Tie up your hair as you like, and I will copy it,"
Flitish said. Granuaile gathered and twisted her hair behind her in a practice series of movements. When she was finished, it was tied against her scalp, pulled back from her ears, and piled in a neat sort of bun on top. Flitish studied it for a few seconds, and then produced a matching bun on her head.
"Not bad at all,"
Granuaile said.
"Here, let's face him,"
the huntress said. They turned toward me, side by side, so that I could compare. Same height and build, same skin tone, though Granuaile had a few more freckles. The hair looked identical now. Up close, you could tell that Flitish's clothes were made of a different material, but from even a mile distance away, it would simply be a black silhouette. Likewise, the minor differences in facial features could be easily distinguished up close, but from a distance in a combat situation, anyone would have trouble telling them apart.
"That'll work," I said. "How shall we proceed?"
"We will appear from the flanks one at a time and throw a knife before going invisible again. We will alternate until we run out of knives. We only have 5 total, correct?"
Granuaile nodded. She had 3 to Flitish's 2.
"Then you should go first,"
Flitish said.
"To them it will appear that the same person is teleporting around them. Quite the distraction. Someone should be able to take advantage of that."
She arched an eyebrow at me, and I nodded. "If it turns out to be possible, target Diana," I said. "She's probably a bit more invested in this than Artemis is, and anything we can do to slow her down would be good." With all of us agreed, we separated to lie in wait. I continued deeper into the woods on the same path, Flitish took off to my left, and Granuaile melted into the trees with Oberon to my right. Once I traveled another 50 yards or so and turned around to face my trail, the directions were switched, with Granuaile waiting somewhere off to my left and Flitish to the right. I drew Fraggaroth from its sheath and stood so that I had a good view through the trees. The first gray fingers of dawn were reaching through the canopy. I cast camouflage as a helicopter chopped the air above the home park, probably very near where we had paused after the explosion. These days, British security would be prone to suspect any attack on Windsor Castle as a terrorist strike, and not even in their wildest theories would they suspect that someone was simply trying to slam a door in my face. The 2 men that Granuaile and I had rendered unconscious by Frogmore House would become a part of the investigation now, and satellite feeds from that area would be scoured. One frame we'd be there, and then the next we'd disappear. That would make them start searching in an ever-widening circle, and eventually they'd get here. Maybe would even spot Artemis and Diana as they were inbound. That would complicate matters. Our duel required privacy. I shuddered merely thinking the word. This wouldn't be a duel. There wouldn't be any rules or codes. They would simply come at me knowing that the worst I could do to them was deliver some brief pain and annoyance. How to placate an implacable foe?
The Morgan's advice came back to me. Gaia loves us more than she loves the Olympians. The solution, I realized to my chagrin, was to take hostages, figuratively as well as literally. I'm not a fan of taking hostages, since it's an act of desperation and so rarely works, and when I kicked Bacchus through a portal, it was more to save my life than anything else. But now I could see how the Olympians would view it as a hostage situation. Right now, my leverage was tenuous. On the one hand, they said they wanted Bacchus back, but on the other, a couple of them were doing everything they could to snuff me. The leverage could change. They knew that if they took Oberon or Granuel, I'd give them anything. There might, however, be a way to increase my leverage, or to at least make them talk, which was the entire problem from my point of view. It wouldn't be pretty, but it had a better chance of working than expecting the Olympians to be reasonable without significant encouragement. It made me wonder why the Morrigan, or the rest of the Tuatha De Danann, or anyone else who'd ever had occasion to fight the Olympians, hadn't thought of compelling them to talk. Perhaps in some cases it was simply not an option for them, but more likely, it never occurred to them that there was any way of winning other than through force of arms. Communicating with Albion through my tattoos, I introduced the elemental to the concept of storage units, in case my plan turned out to work. Chapter 23.
I should be confident of what's to come, but somehow that confidence has fled. With Atticus here, and Flittish too, and the theoretical aid of Hearn, I'm not sure if he's coming back, we ought to be a bit more evenly matched. But nothing went the way I expected it to the last time we tried to ambush the Olympians. I am strategically ill-equipped to deal with them. Unless I land a powerful blow to the head with Scawaja, I don't have a way of taking them out. My knives will only annoy them, and they are so very annoyed with us as it is. Atticus claims that I fight better when I'm angry, and if that's true, I'm sure he's right about the effect, but not the cause. When I fight, I am occupied not only with the exertion, but with the matter in which I win, a distinction that Atticus believes pointless. In battle, there is no moral high ground, he says, only high ground that puts either you or your enemy at a disadvantage, depending on who occupies it. I privately disagree. People can lose or die with dignity. If I could give them that, I would, but I admit that I cease to care if my own dignity is wounded first. With anger comes a remarkable clarity of purpose, a stillness from which many paths to victory lie in front of me. Some paths are much less dignified than others, and the distance to travel much shorter. I need only choose one and take the first step. But I do not have that clarity of purpose yet with the Olympians, for I think they have some just cause to be incensed with us. Though messing with the Dryads on Olympus was ultimately a successful stratagem, it gave us the time to complete my binding to the Earth, I always knew we would have to pay a price for it. Perhaps my insecurity stems from the knowledge that, for the majority of this journey, I have been watched and judged from afar by beings who, if my current run of luck holds true, may prove to be my adversaries someday. Or it could come from the fact that Oberon and I nearly lost our lives the last time, in almost no time at all. My experience thus far has shown that battles in martial arts and action movies always last longer than the real thing, especially when there are gods involved in the real thing. When you're watching in the theater with your salted popcorn and high fructose corn syrup, the battles linger and slow-motion sequences pay exquisite attention to killing blows and masks of rage, a celebration of violent death intended for people like me who, until recently, customarily do nothing more violent than buy butchered meat at the grocery store. Once the movie hero and villain finally have their showdown, they discover that they're evenly matched, and there is time for a long, beautiful silhouette sequence in front of a dawning sun, as the soundtrack composer mashes down some organ keys, and a boys' choir sings whole notes until they drop dead from hypoxia. What makes such shots exceedingly silly is the weeks or months of preparation it takes the actors to rehearse the battle so that they don't accidentally kill each other. If they wanted to truly go at it, they wouldn't need to rehearse. Like all true battles on the individual level, it would be ugly and anguished and over before the cinematographer could focus. I have learned that our emotions and adrenal glands won't have it any other way. I heard the goddesses approach before I saw them, and that saved me from further worry. I had to clear my mind for combat as best I could. The rolling tumble of hooves announced their arrival at the edge of the clearing, where Flittish had left her chariot.
"They're here,"
Oberon said. Holding Scawaja in my left hand and a knife in my right, I cast invisibility on myself and camouflage on Oberon. I also activated the strength and speed bindings worked into the silver and iron knotwork on my staff. "Lie down, Oberon, and their shots should sail high. Don't attack unless they draw near."
"Don't worry about me," he replied. "I almost think barking would be a better distraction than trying to bite them."
"You're probably right." I saw flashes of movement and heard a hushed conversation, and then the huntresses left their chariots and proceeded on foot into the forest, bows ready. Artemis took point, studying the undergrowth ahead and watching the trail for booby traps, while Diana trailed behind, looking up and around for the expected ambush. When Artemis reached the point where we'd split up, she said as much to Diana. Diana told her to keep moving ahead, so Artemis did. I let her pass, and when Diana drew even with me, I threw a knife at her head and shed my invisibility. The knife dropped in flight and sank into the side of her ribs, because her right arm had been raised to fire her bow, exposing her side. "Ha!" I shouted, then flipped the invisibility back on and hit the ground as an arrow from Artemis sailed overhead. Flittish popped into view and threw from the other side, as Diana spun to face where I'd been. She just grasped the hilt of my blade to yank it out when Flittish's knife thunked somewhere in her back, missing the quiver. Another "Ha!" echoed in the forest, and Artemis whiffed with her second arrow as Flittish disappeared. That was my cue. Rising to my feet, I dropped my invisibility and tossed another blade into Diana's chest. I blinked out and pitched forward to the ground, but Artemis didn't take a shot this time. She was distracted, perhaps, by something nearer, most likely Atticus sneaking up from behind. Diana sank to her knees, and Flittish's second knife overshot her. I rose, reappeared, and threw my last knife into the belly. She looked to be in genuine pain, but none of the wounds were fatal. She'd be up and fighting in no time once she pulled those free. We had to finish her before that, and I took three steps before something punched me below the ribs and knocked me back off my feet. As I fell, I saw a black-feathered shaft sprouting from my abdomen. In my haste to lay out Diana, I hadn't gone invisible or dropped to the ground. Atticus hadn't distracted Artemis after all. Instead, she had shot me. My real-life fight had been even shorter than I had feared.
Chapter 24. I was sneaking up on Artemis and had perhaps 15 more yards to go when Oberon shouted in my mind,
"They shot clever girl!"
I yelled, "No!" and tumbled forward as Artemis whirled around and loosed an arrow overhead. Realizing that I had already drawn too close to her for archery, she drew a hunting knife and threw her bow in my direction as I came up out of my somersault. The bow did no harm as it bounced off me, but it did reveal my position. Artemis shifted her feet and presented her right side, blade forward, as her left hand snaked down her thigh and drew another knife from a sheath there. She lunged forward, wickedly fast, and managed to gash me across the chest, right underneath my collarbone. She'd probably been going for my throat, but had misjudged due to my camouflage. I backed up and set myself. Though I wanted nothing so much as to help Granuel, there would be no rushing past Artemis. I told Oberon, "Stay with her. I'll come as soon as I can."
"I will."
Artemis taunted me, realizing that she had scored a hit.
"You are not so skilled at this as the Morrigan."
"Neither are you," I retorted. "You only defeated her because she allowed it." That must have struck a nerve. It was perhaps a doubt she'd already harbored about that duel, because she snarled and charged in. Her left arm was raised and her dagger pointed backward, blade held flat against her wrist and forearm like impromptu armor, while her right was cocked back, ready to strike. I took a risk in the interest of ending it quickly.
Any sort of protracted fight would not work in my favor, knowing that she would wound me, but hoping that it wouldn't be instantly debilitating or fatal. I swept Fragorok clockwise toward her raised and extended left arm, and followed it with my body, shuffling right and planting my right foot so that I could also pivot clockwise. My sword took off her hand at the wrist, and I kept Fragorok moving, whipping it down and around as I spun so that it would catch her as she passed me by. It did catch her, right across the quads of her left leg, but it didn't cut through bone because my strength was gone, leached away since she'd caught me too. The knife in her right hand, a bit tardy, still sheared off a slab of my left lat as she thrust at me while I was spinning. I sprayed blood and she sprayed ichor, and we both had a good howl over what we had lost. The difference was that she went down, thanks to that hack at her leg, and I remained standing. It occurred to me that the Morrigan had almost certainly not used camouflage during her battle. How else would the Huntresses have been able to target her right side so specifically? Artemis couldn't see through mine very well, if at all, so that meant she wasn't getting any help from Minerva or Athena. That supported my theory that the Morrigan had fought to lose. I'd bet money with the Einherjar that after she had said what she wanted to say to me, she had simply stopped fighting and allowed herself to be cut down. Artemis rolled away to create some space between us, and I let her, because I wanted to check on the noise behind me, where Diana was cursing loudly in Latin. She had risen from the ground and removed all the throwing knives, only to be skewered by an arrow from Flittish. As she reached up to tear it loose, another hit her high and toppled her backward. A shimmering effervescence in the air hinted that perhaps Hearn and his hunters were manifesting to provide their promised help, though they were taking their own sweet time at it. Daytime is a notoriously rough stretch for ghosts to do their thing, however, so the fact that he could manifest at all now spoke volumes about his power. A brief glance was all I could afford. Artemis had regained her feet when I turned around, and considering how fast the Olympians healed, I bet her leg would be just fine in another 60 seconds. My back wouldn't heal anywhere near that fast, but neither would she grow another left hand. Her stump had already stopped leaking. I hadn't, though I was working on it. I stalked toward her, not even attempting to be quiet, and she set herself. She looked to be favoring her left leg, but the tiniest of quirks at the edge of her lips gave away that she was faking. She was already just fine, and the surface cut was for show. She'd shifted the grip on her right-hand knife so that the blade pointed down, and if she crossed with her fist, the blade would trail behind, slashing as it went. She was presenting her weak left side, willing to give that up and take more damage there, so long as she could counter with her undamaged right. Well, fuck that. I wasn't going to bite. I came in hard and dropped at the last second, sliding under her haymaker and sweeping her legs out from under her. It was the kind of dirty slide tackle that would get you a red card in football. The momentum from her swing tumbled her across my hips, her right arm stretched out to break her fall, and my right arm, swinging Fragorok down, chopped hers off above the elbow. I thought that would end it, because what would she do, stump me to death? Nope. She rolled over, down my legs, effectively trapping them, and then scissored her right one to kick me in the face and break my nose. My head spun like I'd drunk way too much tequila, and my vision swam with spots as my skull hit the ground. I think I may have blacked out for a few seconds, because the next thing I knew, Hearn was shouting at me, not only fully manifested, but also fully annoyed.
Oi, you dizzy bastard! Wherever you are, what do you want me to do with her?
Head pounding and spots still obscuring my sight, I raised my head to see Hearn and one of his hunters struggling to keep Artemis immobile. They were both trying to keep her legs wrapped up and were having some difficulty. I dispelled my camouflage before speaking. Chop those off, I said, indicating her legs, but not the head.
I was hoping you'd say that.
I rose shakily to my feet and lurched my way toward the spot where Grognuel had fallen. My healing process had stopped the bleeding, but my back and head hurt, until I remembered that I could control that. I shut off the pain as unhinged curses in Greek and Latin followed me, interspersed with wet, chunky sounds as the ghosts methodically removed the limbs from Artemis, and from Diana, too.
Another of Hearn's huntsmen and the pack of hounds had subdued Diana, while Flitish looked on with approval.
Oberon, is she alive? Are you okay?
She's alive, but says it hurts a whole lot. They got her in the middle, Atticus. I'm okay.
Relief shuddered through me, and I paused to collect myself. I had been so worried that she'd been killed outright as Tahira had so long ago. Thank you for staying with her. Ask her to drop your camouflage and her invisibility so I can help. It's safe now. I resumed walking and tried to shake off the clouds in my head.
All right. Hey, there you are,
he said as I drew closer. Where are you? Bark, please. Oberon barked and appeared at the same time off to my left. He was standing watch over Granuaile, who had an arrow in her, just underneath her ribs and slightly left of center. Blood welled around the shaft, and she clutched it, tears streaming down her cheeks, and her breathing labored as I arrived.
It hurts so much, Atticus,
she gasped, the last syllable hitching in her throat.
I didn't think it would hurt this much.
I lay Fragora on the ground as I crashed to my knees next to her. Oberon made room. You have to find your nerves and block them, I said. Remember the binding? Block the pain signals. You shut off the electricity down there, and then you can get to work. She winced.
I can't believe I forgot that.
Shock makes you forget a lot of things. I didn't remember it until recently myself.
You're hurt?
I'll heal, and so will you.
Okay,
she whispered.
Okay, I can do this.
Absolutely. She took a few more quick, shallow breaths, closed her eyes, then spoke the binding I had taught her. She sighed in relief when it worked, then smiled weakly at me through watery eyes.
Oh, that's so much better. Thanks.
Sure, now we can melt these out of you.
No, I already looked. The head and shaft are synthetic composites. We can't unbind them.
Fuck.
No, this is good. It's good, Atticus.
What?
I needed this. I needed to get hit hard and learn how to heal from it.
But you can't heal with that thing stuck inside you.
We'll get it out. Go deal with the Olympians.
They're down already.
There will be more very soon, and you know it. Hermes and Mercury at the very least.
But...
Atticus! Seriously! I've got this.
She reached across with her right hand, clutched my shirt, and gently pulled me down to her lips. She kissed me, and then said, her eyes mere inches from mine,
I'm stable inside and comfortably numb. I'm not leaking stomach acid or anything, and I have the internal bleeding stopped. All I need is for you to get me the hell out of here. You have a plan for that, right? Tell me you have a plan.
I have a plan, I said, and remembered that it was true. She smiled, new tears sheeting down from the corners of her eyes toward the tops of her ears, and I went all melty.
I knew you did,
she said.
I'll do better next time. Now go.
I rose from her lips, but froze before getting to my feet, seeing the arrow again and the sodden bloody circle on her black clothing. I couldn't leave her there. Some very old instincts told me that was impossible.
You look like you just drank some bad beer, Atticus.
Granuaile heard and laughed once before she realized that was probably not a good idea with an arrow in her diaphragm.
Atticus, go. I'll be invisible and safe enough for a while. Don't worry about me.
I ducked back down and kissed her again. All right, I'll go, but only because you would kick my ass if I stayed.
Take Oberon with you. He doesn't want to stay here.
Is that true?
Actually, she's the one who wants me to go. She told me so.
She wants to deal with this alone. That's okay. Speaking aloud, I said, All right, let's do this. Oberon trotted next to me, tail wagging, and I gave him some love. Thanks to Hearn and his boys, Artemis and Diana had been turned into copies of the Black Knight, resting face up on the forest floor with no arms and no legs. Their limbs were nearby, but not close enough to heal, and I could see that, beyond the initial squirt of ichor, the Olympian's remarkable regenerative processes had stopped the bleeding, and they made very tidy torsos. The Morgan's prescience about Hearn's ability to help us was well warranted. I doubted I would have fared so well had he not been there, even with Flittish around. Artemis most likely would have locked her legs around my neck while I was unconscious and snapped it. I thanked Hearn for his assistance, and he nodded but said nothing. He and Flittish helped me haul the pieces of Artemis over to where Diana lay and spread them out so that they were only a few feet apart. I stood between the two bodies, and the goddesses glowered up at me. I didn't mock them or rub my victory in their faces. I kept my expression dispassionate as I set my plan in motion. "Druid ready for storage," I sent to Albion. 10 pieces, my position. Leave large pieces for last. The Earth's magic cannot be used to harm animals of a certain biological complexity. I can use it all I want to give myself an advantage in battle, speed and strength and camouflage and so on, but I can't use it directly against an enemy or a critter that wants to eat me. It's an immutable law and tattooed directly into my skin. But the immortal nature of the Olympians, I realized earlier, provided me with an interesting loophole. They couldn't truly be harmed in any permanent sense by the Earth. Even when decapitated, their heads retain consciousness without oxygen, so I, or rather Albion, could do some things to them we'd never be able to do to any other creature. Underneath the arms and legs of the huntresses, the forest floor began to bubble and shift. Gooey globs of what geologists call London clay rose up and encased their limbs in a dark brown slurry with little fossils sprinkled throughout. This was then coated with a layer of chalk and topped with gravel, which Albion bound together and then smoothed into solid rock.
"What is this?"
Diana asked, swiveling her head from side to side, watching the process unfold. "Your fate," I said. "You will be interred in the earth until you agree to cease hunting me and my friends. No earthquake from Poseidon or Neptune will cough you out of the ground. You will remain in darkness, unheard and undying until I decide to release you. You'd better hope I don't perish in the meantime." The clay began to ooze over their torsos, and once they felt it, their expressions lost much of their vinegar.
"I will cease hunting you and your friends," Artemis said.
My eyebrows shot up at the quick capitulation. "You have my thanks. Diana?" Her defiance returned. She tried to spit at me and missed.
"I will never stop seeking your head," she snarled.
I sucked in air past my teeth. Wow, never is a very long time. "Artemis, thank you very much for offering, but I hope you will forgive me if I don't quite believe you yet. I will be more inclined to do so a bit later, perhaps. You and I will speak again soon." The clay had moved past their shoulders now and was creeping up the columns of their necks. Diana continued to glare at me, while Artemis rolled her eyes down for a nervous look.
"I am an earnest druid. I will swear it."
"Again, I thank you, but you lack credibility at the moment." And there was no way I was letting either of them loose right after they'd shot Gronuel and tried to kill me too. "We've defeated you 3 times now," I reminded them. "Once in the Netherlands, once in the English Channel, and now here. It didn't have to be this way. You might wish to consider, while you're underground, if all this was worth it for the god of drunken assholes and 5 druids who were perfectly healthy when last I saw them. Save for the past few days of self-defense, I have never assaulted you directly and have strived to amend my trespasses. Can you say the same?" "Finish now," I sent to Albion, and the clay flowed to envelop the heads of the 2 huntresses, who screamed curses at me until the gunk cut them off. Once they sank out of sight, mute hunks of rock, safe from any attempt to retrieve them, I looked up in response to a small flutter of wings above. Hugin and Moonin stared down at me from the branch of an elm. "Yeah, I thought you'd show up now. Tell the Einherjar who bet against us to pound sand, Odin. We survived." The raven squawked, but said nothing intelligible. Laughter bubbled up from the throat of Flittish.
"That was amusing, Atticus, and well done. How fares Gronuel?"
I wondered why she had not shown any more concern before now.
She's wounded but stable until we finish here.
Are we not finished?
Not quite. Will you follow me to the edge of the clearing? You too, Hearn.
Certainly,
Flitish replied, and Hearn said aye.
We dislike riding in the sun, he said, but we'll endure for the sake of our guests.
The sun had a proper start on the morning now, and the cloud of debris from Windsor Castle was clearly visible once we reached the edge of the pasture. Helicopters were still circling around the home park, but had yet to stray this far. Shouldn't be much longer, I said. If Odin was watching that all unfold, then I'm sure the Olympians had some eyes on us as well. The ankle-winged boys didn't keep us waiting. Less than a minute later, they zipped in from the south and hovered at 12 feet to deliver their decree from on high.
We bring an urgent message from Jupiter and Zeus,
Mercury boomed. I squinted and held a hand over my eyes to shield them from the sun.
You guys want to talk to me? Get down here. I'm getting a crick in my neck looking up at you.
They floated down but kept themselves a foot off the ground so that they were still looking down at me.
Zeus and Jupiter demand the release of the Huntresses.
No, I said. We're not doing this again. I'm not going to do a long-distance negotiation with the gods of the sky. I want a face-to-face. I purposely turned away from Mercury and locked eyes with Hermes. I want you to bring Zeus and Jupiter here to negotiate in good faith. Safe conduct guaranteed on both sides, or so help me, we will set the Earth against all Olympians, and none of you will ever be able to set foot on this plane again. Is that understood, Hermes? The Greek god nodded, but said nothing. Mercury couldn't stand the lack of attention, and said,
I, not Hermes, deliver messages to Jupiter, druid.
Oberon, take a risk for me. Pee on the Roman's leg and then run.
Why?
You're a guest here too, see?
I don't, but I hope I'll see a T-bone later.
I know that, Mercury, I replied, but I respect Hermes. He's not a jumbo oxbox for one thing. Mercury blanched, and then his complexion colored to a dyspeptic ochre.
What was that?
He said, betwixt ground teeth. He didn't know what a jumbo oxbox was, but he was certain he didn't like being called one. While he worked himself up to a rage, Oberon trotted up behind him and lifted a leg. A yellow stream of urine splashed against Mercury's right leg near the back of the knee and trickled down his calf, wetting one of his wings.
What?
He said, flinching away and twisting to see what had happened. Run, now.
Rah!
Oberon said, as he bunched his legs and leapt away from the swing of Mercury's caduceus. It grazed his ribs but did no damage.
Kerr!
Mercury shouted, and gave chase, cruising above Oberon's back. He swung and whiffed again as Oberon juked to the right.
Yikes! He acts like he's never been peed on before.
Hearn, I said, he's attacked a guest. I waved at Mercury, and before the god could process that he'd overstepped his bounds, he had 3 ghosts on top of him, preventing further flight, and that was just for starters. The hounds leapt at his ankles and tore off his wings with their teeth. They shook the feathers like bird dogs as he fell screaming to the ground. Hermes tensed, ready to fly to Mercury's aid, but I advised him to stay out of it. You have a message to deliver, remember? That gave him pause, and he wafted higher, out of reach. He snarled as he watched Hearn and the hunters dismember Mercury into god cutlets. At my signal, Albion did his part and began to coat the various parts into the crust of the earth. The bags around Hermes' eyes glowed red, and his musical voice said,
There will be a reckoning, druid.
What do you reckon this is, Hermes?
I pointed to Mercury, who was now being covered in clay and hollering about it. This is what will become of all Olympians who seek to put me in my place. I will place them underground in pieces for eternity, unable to heal and unable to die. I don't wish that, however, and I'm sure the Olympians don't wish it either. Nothing has been done that cannot be undone, so please, get you to Zeus and Jupiter too, and ask them to come speak in peace so that we can live in harmony again. Or, at the very least, aggressively ignore one another. Hermes turned his red-rimmed eyes to Flitish.
The Tuatha De Danann condone this behavior?
Flitish cleared her throat before answering in formal, diplomatic tones.
The violence is regrettable, and we have no wish to give offense to Olympus, but it is our view that the druids have acted solely in self-defense, and they have the right to defend themselves.
Hermes snorted in disbelief.
They sundered 5 dryads from their oaks. You believe that was done in self-defense?
It was necessary to contain Faunus if we were to escape Bacchus, I said, unsure that Flitish knew all the details about that episode. So yes, it was self-defense, and the dryads were returned unharmed as Olympus demanded. Hermes ignored me and said to Flitish,
What say you? I say merely this. The druids do the earth's work on this plane, while the Tuatha De Danann are bound by old oaths to remain in Tir na n'Og as much as possible. We therefore wish them to remain alive and free. Can I be clearer?
I almost blurted out, No shit? But schooled my expression to make it seem as if I had expected her unequivocal support all along. In truth, I'd been expecting an assertion of neutrality, even though she and Mananon, not to mention the Morrigan, had already intervened directly. The Greek god huffed, and his eyes flicked once more to Mercury, or rather to where Mercury had been. The earth had swallowed him completely, and his cries could no longer be heard. I just want to talk, I reminded him.
You might not like how the conversation ends,
Hermes said, before rising higher into the sky and winging south toward Olympus. Chapter 25. While Hermes went to go tell his dad on me, I glanced at Flitish and said, I was impressed by what you said. Is that truly what the Tuatha De Danann wish for us? To remain alive and free?
Perhaps not all of them, Flitish admitted, but it is the position of those who matter. It is what Briid wishes.
So, Flitish remained the staunch ally of Briid. I'm relieved to hear it. Please give her my kindest regards. That would serve as a thank you without placing me in her debt.
I will. What's next?
Well, I sure wish Perrin were here.
You do? Why?
Once I explained, she offered to go get him. He'd been hiding out in Tir na n'Og with Briid's permission ever since Loki had destroyed his plane. How are you going to get him? I said. The old way under the castle is rubble now.
It's not the only one around here.
It's not?
Herne's Oak does double duty. It's tethered to Tir na n'Og, but it's also an anchor to an old way. Why do you think we kept influencing England's monarchs to plant new trees in the same spot when the old ones were ripped out?
What? You did? The enormity of her omission hit home. I mean, why didn't you tell me earlier? She grinned, unrepentant.
I wanted to fight, and it was right to do so. The Olympians needed a lesson. But we can leave now if you wish.
Earlier, I would have jumped at the chance, but this was an opportunity to preserve our hides for more than a few hours or days. No, I want to see this through, but if you could take Granuel and Oberon with you, she needs help with the arrow, that would be great. Granuel was fine with the idea, and gladly limped into Flitish's chariot once we went to fetch her. She wobbled and looked a bit piqued, but true to her word, she seemed to have it under control. I gave her a kiss and wished her a speedy recovery. Oberon, however, flatly refused to leave me, and I didn't have the heart to fight him on it. After leaving Granuel in the care of Govnu, who would saw off the arrowhead to allow the shaft to be withdrawn, Flitish came back before Zeus and Jupiter could arrive. She exited her chariot hand in hand with Perrin, the Slavic god of thunder, and her current snogging companion. He looked rejuvenated and spoiling for a fight. His adventures in tailoring were also getting a bit wild. The V in his tight belted tunic plunged precipitously and ended just above his belly button, allowing what appeared to be red shagpile carpeting to spill out. His pants were tucked into blue calf-high boots with a flared top. He looked like a superhero from the 70s. He smiled and gave me a manly hug, which felt like being wrapped up in a throw rug and stomped on.
Vertebrae popped, and my wounded back sent me an outraged query, wondering what the hell I thought I was doing, allowing myself to be crushed like that.
Atticus, it's good to see you. Why does Flitish bring me here?
We need you to appear big and intimidating.
Ah, you need to scare peoples with face of rage.
That's it. He smiled at me.
I can do this. We'll be fun. Look.
He crossed his arms and the atmosphere darkened around him. His eyebrows drew together, and his eyes, normally blue, flickered with the blue and white of lightning as he glowered down at us. He flexed everything and grew bigger.
Yeah, whatever you did, Atticus, apologize. He's breaking bad.
I didn't do anything, Oberon. This is performance art.
Are you sure?
Perrin's visual promise of doom relaxed, and he grinned. The sky brightened immediately.
Is good, yes?
I nodded enthusiastically. That's perfect. Perrin had moved on to greeting Hearn, and I was reminded again that he was one of the nicer gods I'd ever met, at least when he wasn't stirred to anger. He was going to provide me a bit of an edge in the coming psychological warfare. When they arrived, Zeus and Jupiter wouldn't be able to intimidate us with muscles and thunder when we had plenty of that on our side. And I thought it would be important for the Greco-Romans to see that we had a thunder god throwing in his lot with us. They'd accord Perrin some respect and perhaps pause long enough to give me a serious hearing. Without him, I'd expect the Olympians to pummel us into submission without bothering to talk. The current popular image of Zeus as a cheerful, avuncular type perplexes me. I know it comes from a silly kids movie, but I'm not sure they could have gotten it more wrong. Zeus was never avuncular. He killed his father, raped his sister, and then married her, calculating that sanctified incest was marginally better than the unsanctified kind. After that, he conducted a series of what are generously called affairs with mortal women, though sometimes tales will admit he ravished them, which is to say he raped them. He turned into a swan once for a girl with an avian fetish, and another time he manifested as a golden shower over a woman imprisoned in a hole in the ground. His actions clearly paint him as skeevy to the max and the most despicable of examples. He's not the kind of god that belongs in kids' films. He's the kind that releases the Kraken. Thunderclouds condensed and roiled above us, signaling that the gods of the sky had heard my words fall from the lips of Hermes. The messenger god rocketed out of the southern sky and hovered 6 feet above us, safely out of our reach.
"Zeus and Jupiter approach,"
he said, then darted sideways like a hummingbird. The Olympians knew how to make an entrance. A deafening thunderclap boomed in our ears, causing Oberon to yipe, and 2 lightning bolts struck the ground not 10 yards away. Zeus and Jupiter stood in their place. Lightning continued to rain down around us, and clouds boiled directly above, which was odd since we could see blue sky not all that far away. By now, I'd grown used to the difference between the Greeks and Romans, and could immediately tell the two apart. Zeus, the uncredited god of sexual deviancy, had wrapped a thin sheet of polyester material around his waist, like a towel, but was otherwise naked, and was visibly aroused by the opportunity to confront us. His beard, oiled and entirely white, was tied underneath the chin and fell to his sternum. His hair still had a dash of pepper in it here and there, and this fell in oiled waves down his back. Jupiter was dressed, or undressed, in much the same way, but his white beard was cropped close and oil-free. His hair seemed unnaturally black by comparison, with some graying only at the temples. Perhaps he'd been using Just for God's hair cream. Their eyes glowed with menace, and both sets locked on me.
"Enough of this, Druid,"
Jupiter growled.
"Release Bacchus and the others now."
The Olympians I had noticed were not the sort for small talk or pleasantries. They just showed up and demanded that you jump to serve them. "Thanks for coming to talk, Zeus and Jupiter. Look, I'm not the bad guy here."
"You have imprisoned members of our pantheon, have you not?"
"Yes, but that's only because they were behaving like ass napkins. There's something beyond our petty squabbling that requires your attention. It's Loki and Hell and the end of the world as we know it.
Despite what Michael Stipe might think, you will not feel fine when it gets here. You should poke your head outside Olympus once in a while. See, if Loki finds me and manages to kill me, Ragnarok will begin. And most of the Norse gods who were supposed to act as a check on that have checked out prematurely. The threat of Loki is real. He's destroyed the plains of 2 thunder gods already by himself, Perrins of Russia and Ukkos of Finland. The Olympians flicked their eyes to Perrin, who gave them the barest nod of confirmation. The exchange surprised me, because I thought the Olympians would have known about Perrin's plane already, but apparently they hadn't been paying attention to recent events. If Loki is able to unite his power with that of Hel and Muspelheim and pull off Ragnarok, I continued, Olympus goes down in flames with the Earth. So the world could use my help and yours. What do you say we put aside our differences for a bit and fight a common enemy? Odin's with us, I can assure you of that. Name-dropping couldn't hurt at this point. Jupiter's expression of impending wrath modulated into a frown of concern. Zeus's leer underwent a similar transformation. At least they were listening, I thought. But there was no give in Jupiter's tone as he uttered his reply.
We cannot put aside differences until our pantheons are whole again, he said.
Okay, I'm sure we can work something out. Let's talk so everybody wins. But first, could you maybe dispel those storm clouds? I jerked a thumb at the sky. That's weird, and it's going to draw attention.
Attention from whom? Zeus snorted, and glanced toward Windsor Castle and the distant helicopters buzzing like flies around Carrion. I care not what the mortals think,
Oberon said.
Too late, guys. Incoming fireball!
My hound's gaze was fixed on the northern sky. Following it, I saw a familiar orange meteorite with a heart of white phosphorus headed our way.
Ah, damn it!
Chapter 26. Get right behind me and stay low, I ordered Oberon, and then I shouted, Don't kill him or Ragnarok begins! A few scant seconds before Loki landed in our midst and sprayed his surroundings with fire, just to make sure we noticed him. My cold iron amulet protected me, and my body shielded Oberon. Perrin didn't think fast enough to protect Flitish, and she hadn't expected such an attack, so she got tagged badly and screamed as flames engulfed her. Perrin and the Olympians weren't harmed by the fire, but didn't like the intention behind it. Hermes avoided the fire altogether by flying above it. Zeus and Jupiter called down lightning bolts on Loki from their portable storm clouds overhead, but didn't know from experience that he was as immune to them as they were to his fire. Perrin did know, however, and he'd obviously been thinking about how to handle Loki Flamehair if a rematch became necessary. He summoned wind and snuffed out Loki's flames as if they were candles. The mad fucker just laughed that insane laugh and pulled his sword out of his ass. Zeus, now afflicted with acute priapism, gasped and asked him to do that again. Jupiter slapped him to the ground and barked at him to get his priorities straight. Obviously, there was some tension between them. Perrin had the right of it. Neutralization was more important than defeating Loki right now. But Perrin had already crouched down to aid Flitish rather than press his advantage. Before I could step into the fray, Hearn called up his lads. Loki's initial fireburst had set the edges of the clearing aflame, and since it was all part of Windsor Forest, that shot Loki right to the top of Hearn's list of people to kill.
"For the King's Forest!" he yelled.
He and his hunters charged, confident, hounds at their heels, and Loki grinned and waved them on.
Yeah,
he said, a wide smile of malevolence splitting his face. That didn't seem right. The charge of an armed ghost cavalry should have scared the scars off his face. Behind him, a giant hound, 6 feet tall at the shoulders, winked onto the clearing and woofed, then vanished as suddenly as he'd appeared. Hearn, wait! I called, but it was too late. The first huntsman, eager to strike a blow for England, did nothing to avoid the sweep of Loki's sword, thinking it would pass through him as all other weapons did. But Loki, father of Hel, queen of the dead, didn't swing an ordinary hunk of steel. When the sword met the huntsman's form and continued on, a ripping noise like someone's jeans tearing announced that something untoward was happening. The nameless huntsman and his horse split apart and exploded into puffs of floating blue ectoplasm, then faded entirely from view. Loki didn't just wound the ghost. He annihilated him completely. Hearn and the other hunter almost followed in short order, having charged in too far to escape Loki's reach in time, but they managed to muster a defense and were merely knocked off their horses. The spectral hounds, unable to process that the rules had abruptly changed, kept right on going. They nipped at Loki from all sides, and his sword could dispatch only one at a time.
Fucking dogs!
He spat, kicking ineffectually at them.
Hey, I heard that, Oberon said.
A few more frantic stabs of Loki's sword ended the poor pooches, but they had drawn blood and he limped slightly. It did much to subdue his confidence, and by that time Hearn and the remaining huntsmen had regained their feet and approached him warily. Loki took them in and looked annoyed. As successful as he'd been thus far, he had not come here to fight ghosts. Hel must have placed an enchantment on that sword to make it effective against the undead. I wondered if it had a name. Loki backed up, keeping space between himself and Hearn, and rested his twitching gaze on me. He raised a bony finger and wagged it in accusation.
Dwarf can't construct,
he said, repeating the accusation he'd made back in Poland. True. I told him that months ago simply to distract him, and it had worked far better than I ever imagined it would. He could have figured out the truth easily if he had bothered to listen to the dwarfs or asked his daughter, who wanted nothing so much as to please him, but apparently he was determined to do things his way and in his own time. The jerking finger panned to my right.
Zeus! Jupiter! No friends to dwarfs!
I suppose that was his way of building a case against me.
Who you are?
Loki said, and I couldn't tell if it was a question or a statement.
Find out! I will!
I think the Twixters figured out you twicked him, Oberon said.
Hearn and the remaining huntsmen had had their fill of caution. Windsor was on fire and they needed justice. They pressed their attack, weapons held high, and Loki's giant sword crashed down onto Hearn's and slid down its length. The antlered ghost was brought to his knees by the force of the blow, but Loki did no lasting damage. On the upswing, though, he tagged the other huntsman, and the ghost puffed out of existence, decompressed as the blade's magic sundered the ethereal binding of his form. Hearn saw this, and the great sword raised high, ready to fall on him anew. I ran to his aid, since the Olympians would clearly do nothing but watch. I didn't want to kill Loki yet, but I wasn't averse to hurting him, and Hearn didn't deserve to be sent to eternity by an avatar of madness. The sword fell, and Hearn leapt out of the path of the downstroke, attempting to tumble so that he could rise and take a swing at Loki's ankle. It was an excellent strategy, and might have worked, except that blue smoke rose out of the ground all around the giant, and took shape as Draugr, the undead minions of Hel. And the Queen of the Dead herself rose with them, behind her father, as tall as he and stinking of rot and pestilence. Her right side was a vision of loveliness, and her left a wasted husk of a corpse. Without ever glancing our way, she placed her right hand on Loki's shoulder and grated in Old Norse.
Come, father, we have much to discuss.
Then she and Loki melted back into the earth and left us with a dozen blue Draugr to fight. Hearn cursed, and I cursed with him. I didn't want the two of them to confab ever, and now it appeared as if they would, and Loki would learn who I truly was. And it was all because Ukko had freed both Loki and Garm at someone's urging. Garm had clearly healed, tracked Loki here, and told Hel where to find him on Midgard.
"Blood and shite in 57 severed cocks!"
Hearn roared, swinging his sword through the neck of the nearest Draugr.
"I'll be spanked by all the men of Scotland before me mates are wiped out and no one pays for it!"
He kept going like that, slinging curses and lopping off heads, and I joined in lest he be overwhelmed. The Draugr had not been armed and had little defense against our weapons, but anyone could use help against odds like that. Oberon pitched in by knocking a couple of them down, giving us the time to finish them off. Once the Draugr were decomposing into ash at our feet, I turned in disbelief to the Olympians, who hadn't stirred an inch to lend us aid. Zeus closed his eyes in perverse pleasure for a moment before flashing me a crooked grin.
"Who was that tall woman who appeared just now? She wasn't half bad."
"Bloody git,"
Hearn whispered.